Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Human Rights, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Rinveith, the host of this channel, and today we'll be talking to J.C. Salyer about his new book, Court of Injustice, Law Without Recognition in U.S. Immigration. Welcome to the show. And J.C., I was wondering if you could begin this conversation by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah. Well, first, thank you so much for having me. I'm a big fan of New Books Network, so this is a bit of a thrill. I'm an anthropologist by training. I've always sort of focused on immigration in one way or another. Partly because before I did a PhD in anthropology, I was a practicing immigration lawyer. I have a background in law and spent a lot of time, initially working in the criminal justice system and then working on civil rights and constitutional law. I was a lawyer with the American Civil Liberties Union for a while. And that was actually really where I first encountered immigration law. So my background sort of as a lawyer led me in some ways, I think, to get a PhD and try and explore these issues from sort of a more broader context than what you're allowed to do as a lawyer. I mean, I love being a lawyer. I love being able to advocate for people and make some, you know, sometimes good law, sometimes help people with problems they have. But at the same time, as I'm sure we'll talk about in the book, there are very limited channels for making arguments in law. And that doesn't mean lawyers don't see where the problems in society lie and see where the problems in the law lie. But they're just not really an avenue to speak about that in your job as a lawyer. So as I was sort of engaging with immigration law in the post-September 11th context, actually, when people were being detained because they were either Muslim, Arab, South Asian, in jails in New Jersey, and we were trying to sort of figure out what was happening with them, I learned that the immigration law system was actually quite different than what I had dealt with in other areas of law, in criminal justice even, and certainly in constitutional law. And I was sort of naive, I think, because I sort of, expressed my frustration to some of the immigration lawyers that were helping us try and get to the bottom of what was being happening to people in these jails. And it's sort of like, well, just because, September 11th happened doesn't mean they can just throw people's rights out the door. They have to, we still have to have due process. And they kind of looked at me like I was, sort of well-meaning, but very naive. And they're like, no, this is kind of what immigration law has always been. And so I decided that that was quite an interesting problem. And I went back to school and got a PhD in anthropology. And while I was doing that, I started working as a staff attorney for an organization in Brooklyn, the Arab American Family Support Center, where I'm still the staff attorney and run an immigration clinic with them. So that's sort of how I got to immigration law, both as an academic and a legal discipline.
Fantastic. And I appreciate how you've managed to sort of position yourself as well into jumping right into this fantastic book and, giving us a little bit of context as to sort of how you came to this project as well. Something that I found really fascinating, even just in the introduction, was this, I guess even just throughout the whole book, was this shift in scope, which I think is a particular anthropological approach or question, from the broader scope of, the US to the more narrow scope in New York, where you're based and where you work. And even just, through time where, you mentioned September 11th and then also, the book sort of ends with the Trump administration. So also, shifting scope through time. I appreciated that that scope. And I was wondering if you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about that or even just a little bit more about, how you came to this particular project. And I guess just sort of, again, as a follow-up there, I really appreciate this approach of thinking through immigration law, you know, not just as sort of a dry system, but really thinking about how people experience this, people who are, you know, the hearings, but also the lawyers and the judges. And that also seems, you know, a very, very anthropological, a very anthropological question.
Yeah, I think you bring up two things that really motivated me to address the topic and address it the way I did. So that sort of question of, you know, the way immigration is perceived at various times, like after September 11th, you know, I coming to it, not understanding immigration law, I thought, you know, everything has changed because of September 11th. And the immigration lawyers I was working with, you know, sort of correct that naive assumption of mine and, you know, sort of opened my eyes to the fact that what was happening after September 11th was really predicated on the long-standing disparagement of the rights of immigrants. And, you know, even though, you know, perhaps the holding people without access to counsel, holding them without even giving them a charge was sort of extreme, even in that system, it was actually part and parcel of the system that had been operating for a very long time. And I think we see that again with the Trump administration. You know, the scale and the mean-spiritedness of the anti-immigration policies under the Trump administration were spectacular, right? There were no bones about his anti-immigrant sentiments. There were really no bones about his racist underpinnings of his immigration policies. But at the same time, he really wasn't doing anything that wasn't allowed by current law, and he wasn't doing anything that wasn't actually, you know, hadn't been foreshadowed in other administrations in their treatment of immigrants. And so, you know, for me, what was important is to sort of tease out those systems, the mechanisms by which that came to be the way our immigration law works, and to think about how that works in practice and what that means in an immigration case for a non-citizen who's trying to stay with their family, trying to stay in the country, trying to avoid persecution in their home country. So I think for me, you know, that point you make that there's this sort of trajectory of the law that we have to be aware of, and it actually made finishing the book almost impossible, because every day as I was trying to finish it, the Trump administration did some new horrible thing, and I had to decide whether I needed to continue addressing that. But because so much of what was happening was part and parcel of a system that has existed for centuries, you know, I think you can point to those incidents as examples, and like the child separation policy, even horrific examples, but nonetheless examples of the way the law has so dehumanized non-citizens that they can be subjected to, you know, horrific unjust treatment, and we still see that as quote unquote rule of law. So that was sort of one aspect of I think, you know, your point that really motivated me. And then I think that aspect that you raise about the, you know, the way that bigger view of the system then has to be sort of broken down at the individual level, how we have to say, yes, this is a horrible, you know, way of treating people as a whole. And that the immigration law system, if you look at it as a black box, is motivated by lots of things that are very nasty in American history, right? That, you know, the earliest immigration law was the sort of naturalization law in like the 1700s that made it unlawful for anyone who wasn't a white free person to become a citizen. And that sort of racist underpinning we saw, you know, replicated again and again with the Chinese exclusion bar, the Japanese or the Asian exclusion bar, and the Chinese Exclusion Act. And so, you know, we can look at immigration law as a whole and say, yes, this is really problematic. But at the same time, within that bigger system, people are still having to advocate for themselves, and their advocates and their lawyers are still having to advocate for them. And, you know, in that area, yes, we see examples of the injustice that gets carried out in these courts. But at the same time, sometimes people are able to expand or push that law in a way that allows for the recognition of rights, allows for the context of people's lives, and recognize that they are entitled to some kind of relief, some kind of protection, or some kind of recognition. And so really, trying to balance those two things, was one of my big motivations, I think.
I wanted just to also follow up on something that you quickly said just now, and also that was in the book. And I was wondering if you could just briefly maybe just explain some of the surprise that you encountered with working with immigration law after your work with constitutional law. Just for those of us who are sort of outside outside the legal profession, who may not understand these differences.
I apologize. I did not hear that. The connection was not great.
I'm so sorry. I don't know what's going on with this with the internet. Let me see. This is where the benefit of edits comes in later, where right. We can make this all nice and smooth. I was I'll re-ask the question, and this also gives me the benefit of smoothing it out too. I'm wondering about something that you mentioned just now, and also something in the book, which is about the surprise that you encountered in engaging with immigration law, which I think also the surprise feels very anthropological to me. But you know, what sort of was the differences that you encountered, you know, with immigration law, that, you know, a shift away from constitutional law? Just, you know, a brief explanation, or a brief, I don't know, summary of that for those of us who are not lawyers and who might not necessarily understand the context of that surprise.
Yeah. That's a great question. And like I say, it really did sort of motivate me to move into this area, both as a lawyer and a scholar. In some ways, we can understand that there's a lot wrong with society. But at the same time, if you work for an organization like the American Civil Liberties Union, or if you are a criminal defense lawyer, presumably you have not given up the hope that, within that system, you are able to make some change, that you are able to vindicate people's rights. I think there's sort of a way that lawyers have an optimism, and probably have to have an optimism, that they are able to marshal the right facts and marshal the right arguments to get the right result for their clients. And in the constitutional sense, when I worked for the ACLU, that was often the case, partly because we were almost always right. When we didn't bring a case unless we were pretty sure that somebody's constitutional rights were being violated, or somebody's civil rights were being violated. And in that context, it was very often the case that, if the municipality was banning speech, or if a school district was violating student search and seizure rights, that, we could rush into court, explain how this was a violation of somebody's constitutional rights and get an injunction, get a remedy. Sometimes that could happen the same day. And in criminal court, which, has been well documented to be deeply problematic, Michelle Alexander's, sort of treatment of how the structure of the criminal law system, almost forces unjust results, that it's not just happenstance, makes that clear. But at the same time, in the criminal justice context, at the very least, everyone is given a lawyer when they go to court, that, people aren't expected to be able to make legal arguments by themselves and face a government lawyer by themselves. So there is a way that, that was what I understood law to be and what I was expected due process to be. And at the same time, you also expected to be able to appeal those things, right? If, the nature of the beast is that one judge, has to make a decision in a case, but you have a chance to go to a higher court and say, this person got it wrong. Let's calm down. Let's, look at the law. Let's look at precedent, and let's review this and see if that actually makes sense. When I got to the immigration context, none of those sorts of things are part of the system. There's no, there's certainly no right to counsel in the immigration context. The conceit is that immigrants, often non-English speakers, often children, certainly not lawyers, are able to stand in a immigration court and make an argument for themselves against the trained government lawyer who does this every day, day in and day out, right? And what's more, several courts have, including the Supreme Court, have remarked on the complexity of immigration law, right? That, there are all these great quotes about how it's, a labyrinthine system, that it's Byzantine, that it's second only to the Internal Revenue Code in complexity in American law. And we're asking non-citizens who, have no legal training to try and navigate that by themselves. There's no way a system like that is going to produce a just result. The judges they're going in front of aren't judges. They're lawyers who work for the Department of Justice. They have, and we saw this particularly under the Trump administration, but it's always been the case, they have pressures from their employer, the Attorney General, which makes the system inherently unfair. And as I sort of go to pains to say in the book, there are not, it's not necessarily that all immigration judges are bad. A lot of immigration lawyers, particularly in New York, have a lot of good things to say about a lot of the judges they appear in front of. But the system is set up in a way that they're not really in a position to, one, consider all of the things they should be considering, and two, they're not in a position to necessarily render fair results. They're often not given the resources or the time to have a real hearing. So in that way, it doesn't really look anything like, my understanding of what a court proceeding should look like. And then that sort of question of how do we, make sure that they're reaching the right results, that has even been taken away. So, one of the things I talk a lot about in the book is the amendments to the law that took place in 1996, which made it, expanded the grounds on which somebody could be deported, limited the discretion immigration judges had to consider context and grant relief. And then it also really limited courts' ability to review the decisions that immigration judges made to make sure that they're consistent, that they're following the law, and that they're fair. So all of those things sort of taken together have created a system that essentially lacks our understanding of fairness and really isn't set up to reach fair results. That's just not its goal.
Fantastic. Something that I appreciated so much about this book, particularly, I think sometimes when we're thinking about legal systems, legal processes, that it can be very easy to talk about them either as sort of a quick snapshot or as just sort of the black letter law. And something I really loved about this book was that there are these examples. So, for example, in chapter one, there's the example of Omar and that case. And even what you were just mentioning of the situation in New York where immigration lawyers actually seem to think, I was actually surprised by how favorably a number of them thought about the immigration judges as well. And I was thinking as well, just as you were talking, something that I think this book does so well is make it a bit more obvious to those who perhaps don't have the background in the history of immigration law that what was happening under the Trump administration and even what continues to happen is not sort of a surprise. It's not sort of a sudden thing, but it's actually this sort of long process. And this is sort of a long way of also asking. I was really surprised and taken aback by how things like minor crime, things like that actually were such a major factor in the immigration system. And I was wondering if you'd be able to elaborate a little bit more on that.
Yeah, that's a great question. And actually, makes me think that I probably have sort of started out of order, right? Because I've told you that we have this immigration system that is wildly unfair, that it's actually pretty explicit about its contempt for the rights of immigrants, and that it's set up to, probably regulate the flow of immigrants into the United States and not to render anything that we would commonsensically think of as a just result. That's kind of the end of the story, right? So the question is, how did we get to that? And, I think the story of Omar is one of the ways I try and, sort of explain, why we've gotten to the point where, somebody who lived pretty much the whole life in the United States and has committed one crime when they were 15 years old can be put in the system and essentially have their deportation be a foregone conclusion before they even get to open their mouth, right? Just to be super quick, the story of Omar is this young man who gets into essentially a schoolyard fight, bad fight, cuts the other student with a box cutter, particularly after September 11th. Bad thing to do, particularly if you're, Muslim and Arabic, and gets convicted as an adult in New York, even though it happened when he was 15, because we have they have been reformed to a certain extent. But when he was a child, New York had some of the harshest juvenile justice laws in the country. And sort of in the immigration context, that one crime, even though he's never had done anything else, never been in trouble other than that, made him what immigration law calls an aggravated felon. And again, this is an artifact of these 1996 amendments. They're coming out of the Gingrich Republican Contract with America Congress, although happily signed by the Clinton administration. So it's been a bipartisan effort, no doubt. These aggravated felon provisions essentially say, if you are a non-citizen, even a green card holder, right, a lawful permanent resident like he was, and you commit what we call an aggravated felon, which is a very expansive list, even things that we think of as not particularly serious can be considered aggravated felons. In fact, it doesn't even have to be a felony under immigration law to be considered an aggravated felony. So people can commit misdemeanor offenses and not even get jail time and be aggravated felons because it's so broad. But anyway, as a result of Omar being seen as an aggravated felon, the immigration judge wasn't allowed to consider anything about him as an individual and just had to order him deported once he decided he was an aggravated felon. And so, my question is, sort of how do we end up with laws that are so overbroad that, we can deport, children and a child that had evaluated and, they found that he also had, sort of a mental impairment that made him, both have trouble, understanding the proceedings he was in, but also, had trouble dealing with the social situation. So all of these extenuating circumstances that you think should be taken into account, we're not taken into account. I think that the process we see and we see it historically too, with the Chinese Exclusion Act, with, Trump's Muslim ban, with the 96 laws, is that the political sort of impetus to create harsher immigration laws or policies is cast as a response to some sort of threat, usually terrorism, or in the Chinese Exclusion Act case, all of the number of Chinese immigrants coming was seen as like an invading army, and so the government should be given free rein to address that. In 96, the narratives around around immigration sort of shifted from just talking about undocumented immigrants to sort of immigration, being the source of crime, being the source of the threat to the fiscal health of the country, even though what was really happening was globalization, neoliberalism, which is what were making people's lives harder. But immigrants were sort of painted as a result of that. And, the stories that were being pointed to were that, there are these dangerous criminal aliens who are harming American citizens. So we have to pass really harsh laws. And then the laws that get passed are so overly broad that they sweep in their ambit people who bear no resemblance to the harm that the law is supposed to address. And the, you know, sort of part of it that makes it particularly pernicious is that the sort of problem is seen as so important that we have to suspend, you know, the usual rules that we would have, right? And invokes a state of exception that we have this invasion of criminal aliens. So we need to address it. And so the due process rights are limited. The, you know, right to seek review to see if you even fit within the description of the harm that the law was created to address isn't available to you. And so, you know, you end up with a situation like Omar's case where, you know, a 15-year-old with a mental impairment who has a schoolyard fight, even a bad one, is probably not the criminal alien threat to the nation that was contemplated when the laws were created, but they were created in such an overbroad fashion that he's swept within that definition. And then that state of exception also suspends the sorts of normal rules that you would expect in a criminal justice system or a legal system. So he doesn't have the ability to even make the argument that he shouldn't be swept in that category in the first place. So I think, you know, for me, that is sort of the, you know, the way we get to a system that, you know, is so unjust is that's kind of the mechanism that we see operating over and over.
Something that you just touched on now, and also something that was throughout the book a bit, was this idea that judges don't have enough discretion. And reading this, I was kind of surprised by this argument. It wasn't necessarily one that I had considered, but the way that you lay everything out with the examples of sort of how people can be caught up by these overbroad laws that have very serious consequences for people caught up in them. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the importance of judicial discretion and why this is such a major issue, you know, within the immigration context that you're writing about.
Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting because it's it is the, you know, perennial double-edged sword in the legal system that, you know, we want there to be context. We want there to be, you know, some Solomon-esque judge who can met out the right decision. Although really the cutting a baby in half is probably not a good decision either. But at the same time, you know, if you give a judge too much discretion, then you're inviting discrimination, right? We see that in the criminal justice context that sentence length is definitely tied to race and class. Discretion is not a perfect answer to everything. There needs to be a system where we both have judges, able to exercise discretion in the sense of being allowed to consider all the relevant facts, being able to consider all of the context, and not just having the legislature issue these broad categories that sweep all sorts of people in them without any ability to consider, you know, what's the actual level of malfeasance that the individual has committed. And it's important to, you know, remember that in immigration law, you know, we're not talking about, the criminal system where a judge can, issue find somebody guilty, but then, give a lighter sentence if somebody is, seems less culpable. I mean, in immigration, it doesn't matter why you're being deported, you get deported. There is no variation in the penalty, right? If that's the case, we need to be able to have some sort of way for judges issuing those deportation orders to consider the gradation and responsibility, the extenuating circumstances for why somebody may have broken immigration laws, what's their family context, how long they've been in the United States. I mean, at this point, the vast majority of undocumented people in the United States have been in the U.S. for over 13 years on average. In New York, the average person facing deportation has been in the country for, I think, almost 16 years at this point. So, I mean, these are Americans, right? So the need for these kinds of things to be considered, is very important, unless you're going to, unless you're willing to live with that overbreadth and unfairness I just talked about. So, one of the things that, happened in 1996 was a lot of that discretion was taken away from immigration judges. And so, sort of one of the points I make, and mostly through talking to immigration lawyers who have been practicing for a very long time, is that, there's a pretty big difference, a pretty big shift in how immigration proceedings worked between the pre-96 law and the post-96 law, it's both ratcheting up the number of things that you could get deported for, but it's also taking away the ability of judges to consider the equities of people's cases, to understand the context of why they're in immigration court in the first place. And a lot of folks, sort of pointed out in the pre-96 era, you could actually conceivably see a non-citizen without a lawyer going in front of a judge and explaining their case and explaining, who they are, who their family ties are, what their community ties are, and having the judge kind of weigh that up against the immigration violation and deciding whether it's fair to deport them or not. That's been taken away. That's not possible anymore. And just a sort of raw statistical sense, I mean, you kind of see that, in just the number of deportations in the pre and post context. I can't remember what it is, but it's like multifold. It's like, I think the numbers of, deportations in 96 were about 40,000, and it's, almost 10 times that now. So, that's, a direct result of that change in law taking away discretion. And then I give the one example of Jane, a woman who was put in jail for drug trafficking and was sort of on the cusp of that change in law. And her case kind of shows the difference between when the judge has discretion to make these kinds of decisions and when they don't. So she was in a domestic relationship that was abusive. Her partner was dealing drugs. She sort of gets swept up in a drug raid and is considered an aggravated felon because of this drug charge. In immigration law, drugs are about the worst possible thing you can get charged with, despite the fact that at this point, I think almost all of our recent presidents have admitted they're doing drugs. I don't know about Joe Biden, but nonetheless, immigration still sees it as like the most serious thing possible. And so, under this change law in 96, despite the fact that, she was in this abusive relationship. And then when she goes to jail, she takes advantage of every opportunity to reform herself and better herself. She finishes college in jail in a program that a local college is running. She ends up getting a master's degree and actually going into higher ed herself. And none of that can be considered under the sort of post-96 laws. And so she's already deported. But then because of a legal argument that gets made in front of the Supreme Court that says people whose convictions come from before 96 are entitled to the old laws, she's able to sort of say, no, wait, I get to make this argument that my equities can be considered like they used to be because this conviction comes from that earlier day. And once the judge is able to look at all of that, they're like, of course you don't deserve to be deported. And so that's what we've lost, right? By sort of making these broad legislative categories that don't allow judges to think.
That's a fantastic answer. I realize a little bit too that I'm kind of jumping around the book, which I think also speaks to the complexities of the immigration system and the complexities of conversations around migration and bureaucracies. But I wanted to sort of circle back to something that you had briefly touched on, and it's a thread that I found throughout the book, which is, again, I think perhaps a question of scope, but thinking about neoliberalism, but also the need for labor, which seems to be a major motivator for a lot of people to migrate. But also, I was surprised by the way that particular needs for labor really shaped the immigration laws and the history of migration laws. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about sort of how labor, you know, work, things like that was really part of this broader landscape, the broader history, but also even, you know, the contemporary context of migration.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And, you know, obviously sort of weaves its way through the book. I don't think I'd probably analyze it directly enough, but it's sort of hard to ignore labor in the immigration context, right? Immigration is actually been historically primarily a labor issue. The Secretary of Labor used to be the government official in charge of the immigration system until World War II, when it was switched to the Department of Justice. It was actually seen as a question of, do we have enough workers? That has certainly framed the sort of way the issue has been thought of historically, but I think, as you say, also is very much a part of the arguments we hear being mobilized now in terms of why undocumented migration is hurting quote unquote workers. But it also has created the actual infrastructure by which movement between the United States and migrant sending countries was created, right? So, the most obvious example would be the Bracero program, in the way that when the United States felt it needed additional farm workers during World War II, it created this Bracero program whereby it recruited, advertised, asked for migrant laborers from Mexico to come to the United States and work, quote unquote, lawfully. And that continued long after World War II, well into the 60s, because it was so advantageous for big agricultural interests. And sort of interestingly, during that period of time, you also see the consolidation of agriculture into agribusiness, as opposed to being something that was primarily farmer-owned farms. And so that interest in having this cheap migrant farm labor, really drove migration from Mexico and created essentially, the expectation and the infrastructure by which migrants from not just the border areas, but all through Mexico understood that they could come to the United States and work. During the Bracero program, they were advertising in Spanish on local radio stations all over Mexico. So, the United States basically said, please come to the United States and work. That continued even after the Bracero program ended, and was pretty much tacitly accepted. Even in the 1986 law that both created, quote, amnesty for people who had been in the United States for a long time and for agricultural workers who had been in the United States. That law was supposed to create stronger enforcement mechanisms, but those enforcement mechanisms really carved out protections for employers who were hiring undocumented workers. It essentially made it, impossible to prosecute or punish an employer for hiring undocumented workers because the labor interests were so strong in preserving that. So, right up until, modern times, right, present day, we've tacitly, at the very least, accepted undocumented labor as an economic benefit. And the sort of change to seeing migration as a security threat, as a threat to, law and order is a threat to the economy of the United States, either by taking jobs or by taking public welfare that should go to quote unquote Americans, is sort of a change that comes around in the 90s. You know, we see it with Prop 187 in California in 94, where the state has a referendum that tries to essentially make it illegal to be out of status in California, tells government employees they have to turn in people, tries to ban the children of undocumented people from going to public schools, which Supreme Court has found is unconstitutional. So all of that, happens. Almost all of Prop 187 gets found to be unconstitutional and struck down. But all the politicians realized that it was really popular and that the governor of California got reelected by campaigning on this. And so when the 96 election rolls around, everybody is sort of jumping on that bandwagon. Pat Buchanan runs and starts advocating to build a wall along the border. He calls it the Buchanan fence, but, floats this idea that then gets taken up, right, to build a border wall. Hill Clinton, and the Democrats get very anti-immigrant. And so there is this sort of shift where, the political rhetoric is now that immigrants are dangerous and we should crack down and fortify and militarize the border. But at the same time, both migrants and American labor has been under the expectation that, this relationship will continue. There's really, a way that these immigration laws just don't consider the history or the context that people's lives have been constructed under and the expectations that they've been given. And they somehow think that because they've changed the narrative that they can change people's lives.
Fantastic. And I guess just to answer something that you said just at the beginning of that, I think you did a great job of considering migration. I was just really labor. I was just really curious to hear more about that, just because it seemed like a really interesting, a thread. And there are so many threads in talking about migration and bureaucracy and sort of the administration of immigration, I don't know, lack of a better term, management. Something that I found really, really compelling in this book was a discussion about, the theme about under-resourcing or the resources that were available to various parties. You made it very clear that, again, this isn't anything new, that, even before the Trump administration, that judges were overburdened. But something that I found really, I realize it, it might be a bit trite to say jaw-dropping, but jaw-dropping, in your fifth chapter, where you're talking about the New York Immigrant Family Unity Project. And you mentioned in the conclusion that they did a follow-up study and providing universal legal representation showed that successful case outcomes increased by over 1,000%. That was just shocking to me, sort of the lack of resources available to migrants who are in detention or who may be encountering an immigration judge or who might otherwise be, in and around immigration courts. And I would love to hear more about the New York Immigrant Family Unity Project, because it seems like such a very specific, concrete, real world example of potential ways to make things a bit better for people in these really, specific, very quick ways.
I think that's such an important point. And there is a way, and I think immigration scholarship oftentimes, where the criticism of the whole sort of makes you throw up your hands and be like, well, I mean, the only way to fix this is, you know, we need a more cosmopolitan and humane approach to, you know, everyone. And it's like, yeah, have you looked at the Senate lately? That's not going to happen anytime soon. So, you know, are there things we can do within this system to at least, you know, help as many people as possible? And the New York Immigrant Family Unity Project, NYFIP, you know, is sort of this amazing example of, you know, having a very radical transformation of the immigration system without changing a single law. You know, so essentially, it came about, you know, because a court of appeals judge in the federal courts in New York, the Second Circuit, which sits in New York, you know, looked at, you know, these cases that were coming up and realizing that, you know, they were coming up because people didn't have lawyers or the lawyers they had were terrible. And they were not making the legal arguments that could have helped these people or not making the, or not getting the facts documented that could have helped these people. And so the courts were having to, you know, affirm their deportation, even though he could see that, you know, somebody probably could have done something for them. And so out of that came a study that looked at the sort of rate of representation and the impacts of not having representation in New York. And, you know, sort of, you know, the sort of top line, you know, message was folks who were not in detention and who had a lawyer in New York won their immigration cases 73% of the time. Folks who were in detention and didn't have a lawyer won their cases 3% of the time. And so it became really, you know, and there's some compounding factors in there, but, you know, it still became very clear that the reason people were losing their cases wasn't because they didn't have meritorious cases, not because they weren't entitled, even under these crappy laws, to some kind of relief, but because they weren't even able to access the relief that was available to them under this very unfair system. And so, you know, as a result of that, you know, folks, you know, at a lot of nonprofits, the Cardozo Law School, you know, bunch of organizations, Vera Institute were able to lobby the city council to start a pilot project to provide immigrants who were in detention and were at 200% of the poverty line with an attorney. So it was essentially a universal representation system for indigent defendants, like a public defender system in the criminal courts. You know, and in the part they were able to do this by demonstrating that it was actually in the city's best interest, right? That the folks that were being deported were part of the, they were New Yorkers, right? They were part of the city. They were, you know, workers. They were family people who had children. You know, they, it was costing employers money when they lost a well-trained, reliable employee who got deported. It was hurting families when, you know, a parent was deported. It was hurting the city when a parent who was working was deported and the parent and the parent's children had to go on welfare or even were put in foster care. So all of these things that were happening because of the dysfunction of the immigration system were actually hurting the city. And so the argument was, you know, you can actually spend this, you know, it's going to cost you this money no matter what you do. So you might as well give people lawyers. And so, you know, the pilot project was, you know, run for a couple of years and showed, you know, as you say, you know, this huge success in terms of improving the rate at which people won their cases and has been expanded to full funding. So everybody who's detained and meets the criteria in New York receives an attorney. It's been expanded to other parts of New York by the state legislature. I believe there are about 43 other municipal jurisdictions that have started some other version of this. And so it has been, as you say, a very practical, real world way to, you know, challenge these inequities. And then, you know, the benefits have been, you know, both personal, right, that, you know, it is worth doing just because people who didn't deserve to be deported aren't being deported. But it's also having systemic impacts, right? So, you know, first of all, you know, these are excellent lawyers. This is what they do day in and day out. So they're able to challenge the laws, both in terms of their individual clients, but also in terms of the laws themselves, right? They're able to say, this law is unconstitutional, or you are misinterpreting this law, and we're going to make a challenge that goes to, we're going to take it to the Court of Appeals. And through doing that, they've been able to change the immigration laws, at least in their jurisdiction, not just for their clients, but for everybody. It's been, one of the big victories has been on, like I said, controlled substances is, sort of one of the worst things you can get convicted of in immigration contexts. And they've been able to find some relief for folks in that context with a couple cases where they've gotten the interpretation of the law changed. So that's one aspect of it that's creating systemic change. And another is, they've been, also able to see, how the system works, right? How are their clients treated, not just as individuals, but, how are all the immigrant detainees in New York treated? And so they, they actually can advocate for their clients, not just in terms of deportation cases, but in terms of, conditions, how detention facilities are run, how people are treated when they're in detention. Obviously, with COVID, that's become all the more important. And then they also similarly have been able to sort of paint a profile of who their clients are and say, let's think back to why these laws were enacted in the first place. They were enacted because the United States is being overrun by dangerous criminal aliens. And so we need to have these really harsh laws to protect ourselves. And then, you can look at the folks who NYFIP is representing. Who are they? They're basically like every other New Yorker, right? They have the same labor force participation. Like I said earlier, most of them have lived in the United States. The average is they've lived in the U.S. for 16 years. I think a third of them have children in the United States. I think almost half have children in the United States. A third of them are married to someone in the United States, right? So this is, really who is impacted by these laws. It allows us to change the sort of narrative and ask ourselves if this is really how the laws are playing out in reality, and it looked nothing, and the people we're deporting look nothing like the people we said we were afraid of, maybe we should change the laws.
So I could talk to you about this book for hours, but I realize we are quickly approaching the end of our time together. And something that you mentioned at the beginning of even as you were writing this, every day the Trump administration would come out with something new, and so having to sort of constantly update things, again with the caveat that talking about migration can be sort of taking a quick sort of temporal snapshot. It was interesting for me to be reading this at a time when the news of Afghan refugees is in the news in the U.S., as well as some really upsetting news coming out about Haitian asylum seekers. And so I was wondering if you would have if you could tell us a little bit about sort of how you see this project or this sort of work happening now, or if this is a, I'm going to re-ask the question. I'm wondering if you're, I'm wondering how you are considering these questions that you bring up in this book now in the sort of contemporary climate, how you're thinking of, the changes that have even happened, post Trump administration, because we're under the Biden administration now. And if you could give us, any insight into sort of the current projects that you're working on, or ways that you see this particular project still speaking to the news really today.
Yeah, I mean it's a good question, and it's really hard to answer, right? I think in one way, I feel as though, a lot of what I'm trying to say in the book, at least in its broadest sense, helps me understand what's going on, right? So, there is a level at which U.S. immigration law bipartisanly has been about dehumanizing migrants, dehumanizing non-citizens, and thinking them as someone who is entitled to less in terms of their legal rights and entitled to less in terms of what they should expect from life and the sort of dignity and recognition they should get. And I think, it is clear from the sort of Biden administration's response to its handling of Afghanistan that, they just did not provide any real consideration for the lives of people who their actions, they being the United States government's actions, had imperiled, right? That these are people who, agreed to work with the United States, agreed to take part in the nation building project that the United States started in Afghanistan. And then we're essentially not thought of as, entitled to consideration when it was time to go. And talking to lawyers that have worked specifically on this issue, it came as no surprise to them that, something like this would happen. The people with special immigrant visas applications, which is primarily or a lot of the folks they were talking about, had been pushing to get those adjudicated and issued, not just months ago, years ago, and it just wasn't seen as a priority, there is a way that, I think both in that and certainly in the Haitian context, groups of non-citizens are just not seen as rights-bearing individuals. So I think that's definitely part of it. I mean, in terms of, where I've gone, with that sort of overall thought process in other contexts, one other project that I have worked on recently is looking at the Australia policy towards asylum seekers who try to arrive by boat. And they instituted this policy, that they called no benefit, where essentially if you were an asylum seeker, and the vast, vast majority of asylum seekers that came to Australia by boat were found to be genuine asylum seekers, something like 85%. So these are actual refugees that were trying to seek refuge in Australia. But Australia said, no, if you come in an irregular fashion, right, if you come by boat, we're not just going to detain you while we decide your immigration case, decide whether you're an actual refugee entitled to protection under international law. Even if we decide that you are a refugee, which happened in the vast, vast majority of cases, we're not going to let you come to Australia. We're going to resettle you in a third country. And they placed people in an island that's part of the nation of Papua New Guinea on Manus Island, and then the island nation of Nauru. And along with another anthropologist, Paige West, I did a project where we looked at that process in Papua New Guinea. And there's a lot of complexity to it, but, I think the underlying, part of it is that, countries like the United States, countries like Australia feel like they can use the argument of their sovereign border as a way to, essentially end any conversation about what they owe other people in the world. So that's sort of one of the ways I've been trying to think about, maybe outside the U.S. context.
Fantastic. That sounds like a really compelling additional project as well. And I want to just thank you so much for being on the show today. I really enjoyed our conversation, and take care.
Thank you. This was great.